My name is Kevin Leander. I'm in the Department of Teaching and Learning and teach there along with my colleague Bridget Dalton, who couldn't be here this evening. We have a group of doctoral students who are involved in a research group together that we call New Media and Learning, and we'll be presenting and sharing with you tonight about research, inquiry-based writing, information-based writing across the disciplines. And we would like to share a particular approach with you. We want to thank Jen for organizing this and for inviting us to be part of this symposium. And one of the things, as you can see, that we take seriously as part of our responsibility is providing a very large group that will can supply either audience or panelists for our presentations. We're setting up today our discussion as a kind of polemic between traditional research writing and research writing that is more geared toward Web 2.0 culture. To a certain extent, we mean to offend with our polemic, but we also recognize that traditional research writing has value, and it has gotten all of us to where we are today, for good or for bad. It has informed our own mindsets, but we also want to stretch and critique current mindsets in the academy about traditional research writing. That's the sort of underlying purpose of our presentation today, as well as showing an extended example of what an alternative might look like. I have no idea if I'm coming across more strongly than the music, or if I'm blending with the music and it's all a pleasing experience for you. But I'm going to allow the doctoral students to introduce themselves as they come up and present. And again, thank you for coming.
My name is Nate Phillips. Emily Bigelow and I are going to talk about sort of the foundation for our thinking about the relationship between traditional research writing and the research writing report and what we've come to call iSearch 2.0. This relationship is based on a middle ground that we're really not going to focus on much throughout the presentation, but it's important in understanding why we've called it what we did. And that is iSearch, capital iSearch, we call it 1.0. Initially, with what we call research 0.0, and kind of see this as almost a caricature of traditional research and writing, particularly at the secondary level, then 25 years ago, Ken McCrory suggested something called iSearch, which allowed students to have a more personal take on the research report. So rather than having an assigned topic, maybe they could dig for topics that they were interested in and also be able to present that information more narratively. This was particularly influenced by new journalism and the idea that stories could be told through the research process. And so we've kind of, using that iSearch language, then moved into lowercase iSearch to sort of hint at the importance of Web 2.0 culture and technologies in what we're talking about. So our purpose is to push the movement from Research 0.0 to iSearch 2.0. And most of the presentation will focus on a specific example and discourse around iSearch 2.0. But Emily and I are going to just sort of briefly highlight what the shift would look like moving from traditional research to what we've come to call iSearch 2.0. In thinking about Web 2.0 culture and technology, we've been influenced by Henry Jenkins' book, Convergence Culture, and also a key 2005 piece by Tim O'Reilly. I'm really, really quickly going to highlight key distinctions between Research 0.0 and iSearch 2.0. In doing this, I hope you'll recognize that there'll be a lot more focused discussion about iSearch 2.0 later on in the presentation, including specific examples about how this might look in a classroom and with students. But we wanted to set up the shift, what that looks like, what we're proposing is a shift from 0.0 and pushing towards including Web 2.0 culture and technology. So the first question finding in Research 0.0 is the idea that the point of finding a topic for the research paper is the teacher gives you maybe a topic, you have a question that has an answer, and you go look for the answer. So begin with question finding. As opposed to messing about, this terminology comes from a recent report about student youth, or about youth online culture, and includes the ability to go look for things and spend some time thinking about personal interests as well as interest group affiliation. known information. So with your question, the goal of Research 0.0 is to go find the answer to the question. The answer is known. You just have to go seek it out and get it. As opposed to edge of knowledge. So even finding groups that are creating knowledge, a good way to think about this would be something like Wikipedia, in which knowledge is being created and shared among interested people. An impersonal stance would highlight Research 0.0. I'm separate from the information. As someone who is writing this report, I go find it, but I'm not really invested in it. As opposed to a social negotiation of knowledge, in which I work with people who are interested in creating knowledge and thinking about different areas of interest and working together to find new information, create information together. The report is something you hand in to the teacher, and it's on paper and it stays all together, as opposed to the idea of multiple distributions. So we might present to audiences outside of the teacher and classroom. The multiple there is also meant to evoke the idea of multiple modes and multiple genres. Source documentation, where you got the known information from, you let everybody know that, as opposed to tracing sources, so being much more critical about where the information came from, who had it, and following those paths in order to be able to report the source of information. Finally, publishing up, which is handing the paper into your teacher, as opposed to publishing out, looking for interested people who are looking for and invested in this information. Emily's going to focus on just one of these areas. We could spend some time kind of highlighting each of them, and there'll be more about the specific ones throughout the presentation. She's going to focus just on known information to give you a specific idea of what the shift looks like.
So looking at known information in the traditional writing of a research project, we have students that are going to be relying on printed texts such as encyclopedia and reference books. And through this, the information that the students gain, it tends to be not valued as much as the actual source of the information. Students, in a sense, pretend to be experts as opposed to actually truly becoming experts, and they're approximating the knowledge that they've acquired from these reference texts. Looking forward to this shift, in iSearch 2.0, students are encouraged to look to other perspectives through their interaction with online communities, personal blogs, and connecting with people via email or instant messaging that they might not otherwise have the chance to connect with. Allowing for this participation through these types of activities gives students a chance to move beyond the center of knowledge and instead look to the edges and even to work towards creating the knowledge that is available. So this has given you a really brief overview of what we have conceived as the shift from Research 0.0 to the iSearch 2.0. And the rest of the presentation is going to look more specifically at our vision of iSearch 2.0 and they're going to flesh it out with concrete examples so that you can see exactly what iSearch 2.0 could look like. So I'm going to turn it over now to Blaine. And I'm going to be talking about beginning the iSearch 2.0 process, which begins with question finding. And traditionally, students pick a topic for a research paper from a list provided by the teacher, or they're allowed to choose, and many times asked to generate a topic on the spot with very little reflection or time to formulate that question. And educational research has shown that students rarely access prior knowledge or experience with a topic before starting their inquiry. And many times students ask superficial questions, which lead to factual answers, and or they abandon the question if they find difficulty in their search. A recent MacArthur Foundation study revealed that young people naturally inquire online by messing about, which involves tinkering, exploring, and extending their understanding on a topic. When messing about, young people are drawn to self-directed, peer-based, and interest-driven learning. And it's an investigative phase where the risks are low, so there's more trial and error and even failure. You can discard a topic if it's not working for you. And it also involves kind of lurking around in different places and looking at chat rooms or different forums to try out a topic to see if it'll work. And many times for messing about online, you'll move on to geeking out or looking at it in more depth and, you know, starting to participate with the communities and learn from others and then also share your knowledge on it. Research has also shown that students prefer to browse the internet to locate information rather than searching for specific keywords or having a teacher tell you particular websites to go to. In addition, students are more successful with ill-defined tasks that allow for more freedom as opposed to well-defined tasks which can be confining. And lastly, when students are allowed to generate their own topics for research, it's been found that they have much more motivation, they're more challenged, engaged, successful when they pursue the topic than if it's imposed on them. And there's also a difference in the quality of output. The iSearch 2.0 framework for searching for a question complements the way that young people naturally inquire online and the technologies that they use. And the first distinction is that it starts with a question instead of a topic. So the aim is for the students to research something that they're genuinely interested in and want to learn about. Students are metacognitively aware of their motives and their process throughout, as well as have the ability to self-regulate their search. And in order to refine their questions, students participate in knowledge and social communities where they learn from and connect to other people who share the same interest. It involves a variety of modes, and it's usually concerning a social issue of relevance that's timely. Students' identity is shaped through this process by deciding which kind of movements or groups or even the question they'd like to align themselves with. And the overall goal for the question is some sort of ultimate contribution, which can take many forms, including sharing your knowledge with that online participation community, organizing an event, and or creating something. So to demonstrate the question-finding process with iSearch 2.0 and how it looks, I'm going to show you kind of the thought process that a student could be going through. And this trajectory is also indicative of the thinking that our research group went to and coming to a question, as well as my journey with this topic. So it began with the larger domain of how can we improve our community. And from that domain, I reflected on things that matter to me, what I already know, what I'd like to know, different ways that I can contribute with my skills, and what type of community or people I'd like to align myself with. And so it's important to also note that this reflection doesn't just happen at the beginning of the process, but also is throughout. So upon reflection, I thought about some larger domains of interest that could work as entry points for my iSearch. And the first one that came to mind was the health of Nashville's citizens. So after reading that Tennessee ranks 42nd in the nation for overall health and well-being, I thought that this would be an important place to start. So I started messing about online, and I went to different websites and was able to use links to kind of go through a web of what's going on in Nashville with organizations and issues here. And I realized that the issue was a little too broad and it wasn't exactly what I was looking for, and I felt that I wouldn't be able to make that large of a contribution that I was hoping for as well. And so then I thought of another domain I could enter, and the second one is the environment. So from moving here on campus and in Nashville, I've noticed there's not very many recycling bins, and so that made me think about recycling in Nashville. And I also recalled a recycling initiative from my first inquiry, which I was able to use as a point of entry into starting here. And I found several recycling participation communities, but none of them really seemed like the right fit. There was Green Moms and other high school-based communities, but they just didn't seem right. But along the way, I felt like I belonged with the Cool People Care group, and so I received... That's a group they send emails every day about ways to get involved with the community and kind of what's going on. And I received an email about the Walk Bike Nashville movement. And so that kind of piqued my interest. So from there, I was reflecting also and thinking about my kind of where I belong with this. I like to bike, and I've noticed that there's very few bike lanes. And I've also had some scary experiences on my bike in town. Also, I liked this domain because it connected to my other two domains of health and the environment. And I was also became even more interested when I read a blog about a local cyclist who was recently killed and heard some other stories from cyclists online. So in deciding that this would be a good domain for me, I decided that I needed to refine it. And so I was able to do that through interaction with content and people. And these are just the few ways I was able to refine my question. So from communicating online and offline with knowledgeable people, including classmates or people I know who ride bikes in Asheville, and then also getting into forums and chatting online with people so I could really see what the issue is and where there's a need for some sort of action. Listening to podcasts, watching videos, I saw a map of the current bike routes in Asheville. I looked at an urban design website on bike paths to learn a little bit more about that and possible ways to contribute. And then lastly, I was able to identify some ways that I can contribute that kind of, they range from just personally and finding a safe way to get around town to possibly recruiting other online interest groups in a campaign and then answering this question and being able to share what I've learned with decision makers. So I came to a lot of questions through this, but the one that seemed the best for me and thinking about what I'm interested in and my needs and doing this reflection is, what are the best places for new bike paths in Asheville? And so from question finding, we'll now move on to answering that question and finding the best platform to share what you've learned.
Hi, I'm Erin Vandewater. Walt Colt and I will be presenting on how to discipline research practices and how to make expert thinking visible in different disciplines in iSearch 2.0. So going back to our question from the previous phase, what are the best places for new bike paths in Nashville? We're going to attempt to emulate an information finding process that's a little abbreviated using theories of social constructivism as well as problem and project-based learning. This is a process that makes expert thinking visible in a variety of disciplines while allowing the learners to practice those kinds of expert thinking. And this process also gives experts a chance to connect with fresh insights and encourages and guides new thinkers outside their realm of expertise. So using Cooper and colleagues' 2005 literature review on the web as an information resource in K-12 education, we learn a few things. First, that questions should be problematic so that learners don't automatically know what the answer to the question is. A writer's goal should be more complex than simply finding a previously established right answer. And the purpose of Research 2.0 should be not to confirm old beliefs, but rather to pose new questions and follow through with solutions that can be created from those questions. So for the biking question, we decided to make the solution relevant by presenting our findings to NAMPO, which is the Nashville Area Metropolitan Planning Organization. This is their website. They specifically are involved in a movement with trying to increase the use of biking and pedestrian transportation. Research says that learners should research and write to synthesize information and disseminate solutions. So we developed this conceptual model of the process, of the problem-solving process. Web 2.0 gives learners a chance to engage with and to write for experts and to work with one another. So in this model, students move from the question phase into branching out into a variety of information sources. In this process, ideally, they'll be documenting their decision paths, and they'll be influenced and guided by teachers using cognitive scaffolds as well as media interpretation scaffolds to help their process. From these information sources, they'll gather their information in a synthesis process to form a single solution. Research in problem-based and constructive learning says that learners should be able to connect their learning in other disciplines and other content areas. So these are some examples of how we thought different disciplines might be able to inform this process, what they might advocate as necessary contributions to this process, all of which should be considered as part of a thorough solution, possibly depending on the considerations and needs of the audience. So this process engages a social negotiation of knowledge, which is something that we feel is central to the iSearch 2.0 process. It utilizes not only a variety of knowledge, but a variety of standards for what constitutes evidence, what constitutes a problem-solving process, and research procedures. So we're going to highlight now the process of source tracing, which can look very different from the traditional research procedure of strictly going back to a reference all the time. So using our biking example, let's say the first thing we want to use is a cost-benefit analysis to help us inform the best places for new bike paths. First, we ideally need to know whether this area will be city or suburban. And to find that, we need to look into some more questions, specifically what budget constraints are in different areas, what paths commuters normally take, what the biking community feels are the best areas, and what current bike paths are already in Asheville. We'd also need to consider what kinds of routes we would like. There's bike paths, bike lanes, adjacent to roads, greenways. And so to consider that, we need to also look to a biking community to see like where they like to bike, what they feel the needs are, as well as statistics for safety in these different types of bike routes. And last, we need to look to other kinds of facilities for biking that we might want to incorporate, like bike signs, racks for buses, public bike racks. And to inform that, we'd again maybe look to the community of bikers that already exists, as well as statistics on safety. So as you can see, this is quite a branching process. It moves a lot more outward than downward. And this is just an abbreviation of the actual process that learners will ideally take. So these are some websites we happened upon through this process. I'm going to go through them one by one as screenshots. The first one is musiccitymoves.org, and what we found useful here was a map of current Nashville bike routes. They're color-coded by type. The next one is found in bicyclinginfo.org, which provides a nice link to a cost-benefit analysis, ideally made for cities who want to implement new bike paths. The next one is mapmyride.com. The first thing we found useful on this website was a blog by current bikers. It allows them to map their current bike routes, and so we thought that this might be a good source of aggregate data if we're looking to the highest needs areas. And the next one is surveymonkey.com, which is an online survey feature that allows for mass dissemination of questions you're interested in on the online community. So we, again, thought that this would be a good way to aggregate some data from the biking community. The next one is citydata.com. It allows users to access more statistics than they'd ever want to know about, searchable by zip code. This is the Department of Transportation website, again providing statistics about safety, including motorist and biker accident information. KenKiefer.com provides links to numerous sites that incorporate statistics about bike safety. And the book Traffic by Tom Vanderbilt is a nice compilation of experiments that have been done in other cities involving bike safety and possible solutions for incorporating new bike paths.
All right, so through her research, our iSearch, or rather I should say her iSearch, she's found these four items. These first two actually come from Germany, the Netherlands, England, and Florida. They found that if you actually make the roads less safe, if you put more obstacles in drivers' way, they drive safer. And they also find that if you take away the bike lanes, like say on Belmont, if they actually stripped away all those lanes, drivers would actually drive safer, because what those lanes are telling these people are, this is the limit that you can go. Whereas if you take them away, they just instinctively stay away more from bicyclists. So the iSearchers also found that there are already a number of bike paths in Nashville. They're kind of not very well connected yet, though. But Nashville has made a commitment. So the iSearcher went through a cost-benefit analysis tool found on the web, and found that for 3,000 feet of bicycle lanes with signs would cost the city $34,000. But through her research about Nashville, she's found that the city is actually already willing to invest more than that. They've done that in the past. They've invested more than that. But she's also discovered that Nashville has found that the findings from England and Germany and the Netherlands are opposite. They found that for the roads that don't have bike lanes, there have been more accidents as opposed to roads that do, like Belmont. So as a teacher working with the eye searcher, she's gonna guide the eye searcher throughout the entire process. So we're talking about through the initial strategy for the research itself, to guiding questions when she's doing the research, and then to the approach and the arguments that she should take when she presents the material. And before I leave here, she might do this through scaffolding. She might, throughout the entire process for the eye searcher, she might just kind of sit with her during various stages of the eye search process and, give her some of these questions. The authors in our lit reviews said that, or recommended that you explicitly provide these kind of questions and scaffolding to students to guide them each step of the way. And then the guiding questions through the research itself and then the approaches. So while the eye searcher is doing the research herself, these are actually five questions from the Center for Media Literacy that they suggest that the eye searcher go through when they're reviewing the research itself, when they're actually reading the material or viewing the videos or doing whatever. And all right, so the first one is, who created the message? So of course, all media is created. All media, people make media messages. In the past, in my past lives, I've been a newspaper reporter. I've been a public relations writer, a copywriter. So, as a creator of these media messages, I wore different hats. Say, there's me in my academic life. There's been me in, as a functionary of a corporation. So the researcher constantly has to be thinking about, who created this. And then the second part is, right, each form of media has its own rules and its own language. And so the eye searcher has to be thinking about this while they're, for example, film. Film uses a lot of jump cuts, a lot of, editing tricks, plus retailers use sound and smell to get you past your normal guards, your normal defenses. How might different people understand the different messages differently? Me, as a progressive, when I see Bill O'Reilly or Rachel Maddow, I'm going to take away different things than, say, Dick Cheney. So as a creator of media messages in the past, I naturally kind of embedded in my own values and my own lifestyle beliefs into my messages. And this is another question that the eye searcher has to consider when she's viewing this material. And finally, she has to consider what the purpose of the message is. And of course, this purpose might be explicit, it might be implicit. The author himself might not even know why, or rather, know all of the messages he's transmitting. And this is page 75 from the manual from the Center for Media Literacy. And if anybody's interested, I can send you the PDF for this file. It's free and it's available on the web. So when we have learners go through the iSearch process, we don't want them just to go out and find information. We want them to actually synthesize it and manipulate it, think about it, and we want them to come back and make a contribution to a field. We also want them to go out and take material from as many subject areas that relate to the topic as possible. And again, we want all this information to come back and make an actual contribution. So when the eye searcher presents her solution, we want her to take a stand. We don't want her to have the stand first and then, match the material to the stand. We want her to go through the material, think about it, weigh the different options, of course with the help of her teacher, and then come back and make a stand. We want her to to reach out to the stakeholders and subject matter experts related in the field. We don't, you know, no person is an island. So we want her going out and making these connections through, you know, Web 2.0 tools as well, you know, through before 2.0. We also want to give the learners different entry points into the material, and that's what we're discussing here with represented collection mini data formats. So, you know, many learners have many different learning styles, and we want to be able to incorporate all or as many as possible when we present our final solution, or how the iSearcher presents her final solution. And the final one is just again, talking about the audience. We want the iSearcher not only thinking about herself, but thinking about her audience constantly. So these are four possible solutions that our iSearcher in our scenario is contemplating, that she's weighing. She hasn't made a decision just yet on this slide, but these are just four, based on the research she's done that I mentioned towards the top here. And then finally, she decides to make a proposal. She's making a proposal to the Nashville Area Metropolitan Planning Organization. She's gonna suggest that there be bike paths connecting these three roads here. All of these final lanes are going to be connecting already existing bike lanes in Nashville. They're all downtown. They'll probably all entail kind of changing highway-like roads into more neighborly boulevard roads, probably putting in some obstacles like I was discussing towards the top to make it more difficult for the drivers. This may also entail, you know, there's going to be a lot of money hopefully coming in through the stimulus package for infrastructure, and all of these roads are top prime candidates for that. And this is just a map showing the different areas we're discussing here.
Tara Alvey, and I'll be talking about composing the final product. So at this point, we have done lots of exploring, we found lots of great information, we have some proposed solutions. So the question now is, what do we do with that information? How do we disseminate it to people who care? So we can trace ideas about publication historically. Dating back to the 14th century, publication was thought of as the act of making something publicly known. We've also seen historically that academic writing has separated the moment of production from the moment of consumption. So I'm producing it now, and then later, somewhere down the road, it will be consumed by some audience. Historically, academic writing has also separated private from public media spaces, meaning that the production typically takes place in private settings. And so I'm not going to put it out there in the public until I'm completely finished with it. And so the public only gets to see it after I've spent a lot of work and I've finished my production and I've moved on. Henry Jenkins, in his book Convergence Culture, which a couple of my colleagues have referenced, says this. He says, "What holds a collective intelligence together is not the possession of knowledge, which is relatively static, but the social process of acquiring knowledge, which is dynamic and participatory, continually testing and affirming the group's social ties." So it's not a matter of either having the knowledge or not having the knowledge, but instead it's about knowledge that is acquired and shared and engaged in through participatory networks. And so this encourages a move away from what we call publishing up, and that refers to publishing up to the teacher. So I write my report and I turn it into someone who's more of an expert in the field than I am, and then it's that expert's job to determine whether or not I have enough knowledge. And so we're pushing away from that and instead pushing to this idea of publishing out. So I'm disseminating information to a collective group who has some knowledge and can learn from me and I can learn from them. So as we think about what it means to publish in iSearch 2.0, one of the questions that we can ask is, what is the community for whom this piece is being created? And here we go back to the idea of publishing out. So knowledge is open-ended. It isn't closed with the submission of the report. If you think about a traditional research report, when I print it and I turn it into my teacher, it's done. That's it. I'm not going to touch anything else. It's over. But in this case, we're encouraging that knowledge continues to be acted upon. It continues to be dynamic and revised and added to. Some of my colleagues referred to before that it's at the borders of diverse communities. The knowledge is at the borders of those communities. It's not things that everybody has known and keeps saying over and over again, but instead it's really pushing out to the borders with this knowledge. The contributions are motivated by collective engagement, which relates to the previous discussion of collective intelligence. And one really important point here is then this idea of publishing out, that the knowing game continues. It's not over when I turn in that report. It's going to continue, and I'll continue to be engaged in it. We can also ask what opportunities exist for personalization and expression in iSearch 2.0 products. In this type of composition, students take a personal and socially critical stance instead of that impersonal stance that we typically see in traditional research reports. They really have a personal investment, and they're critiquing the social implications of their topic. Rather than the usual measures of authority, here we see social engagement becomes a measure of authority. And so in the communities that students would be participating in, the level of participation is a measure of their sort of status in that community. And so students really do have the opportunity to gain authority and status in those communities instead of being, as I think Emily said, sort of approximating that expert knowledge. They really have the opportunity to gain status. And finally, there are opportunities for personalization and sort of adding aesthetic appeal, and I'll show you some examples of that as we move on. So here is a list of some possible products in social media. These are some of the things that students might produce after going through this process of iSearch 2.0. And this list is not exhaustive. I'm sure that you can think of other things that aren't on here, but this is just to sort of give you some ideas about what it might look like. So for example, if a student decided they were going to contribute to a wiki, maybe they were going to contribute to a Wikipedia entry on, with the case of our example, maybe bicycle commuting or bike paths or bicycle safety might be some of the things. Maybe if there isn't an entry available, they create the entry. And this kind of contribution it's certainly more appropriate for some topics than for others. There are some topics where a Wikipedia entry just wouldn't make sense. But for some, that might be a really good way to contribute. And students could really see how their knowledge is being used and it's being revised, because in Wikipedia they can see how people are adding to it. Blogs I'm not going to talk about now, because I'm going to show you a couple examples of that in just a minute. But we could also look at social networking sites. We see groups popping up on Facebook surrounding bicycle safety and adding bike paths and getting people to go out to public meetings. And so there are lots of groups like this that are sharing knowledge and discussing issues and encouraging people to really take action on some of these issues. All right, so here's an example of what a blog related to bicycling in Nashville might look like. On the left, we have an official blog that is created by an organization. It's run by sort of an official group. And on the right, we have a personal blog. So it's created by an individual who is interested in biking in Nashville. Both of these blogs cover a lot of the same issues. In fact, they even have posts on some of the exact same topics. But they do a lot of things in different ways. They're covering a lot of these characteristics that we've talked about, but they do them in different ways, and so we'll walk through some of those. Both are absolutely participatory. They allow opportunities for others to engage. They reach out to these interest group audiences. The knowledge is dynamic. That knowledge game continues, like we talked about. And just looking at them, you can see that they both have opportunities for you to personalize to your own taste, just in terms of even the color and the template. And here you see this guy has some things related to Yazoo, like, that he's interested in. You know, so there are lots of opportunities for sort of personalizing to your own tastes. Okay, so if we look at just a couple of these things, these characteristics that I mentioned, we'll start with personal and social stance. So both blogs are offering discussion of and commentary on current events from a personal and socially critical stance. The official blog calls its audience to action and asks them to attend this public meeting that this blog is about. While this official blog tends to keep a more kind of official sounding stance, it's still obviously coming from the standpoint of this group, but they try to sound a little bit more official about it. This personal blog tends to take a sort of ironic and sarcastic stance, to put out their personal beliefs. And so in this case, they're talking about this, you can see the picture here, but they're talking about this issue of people that want to ban bicycles from roads. And so part of his blog here says, so I would like to apologize for every cyclist that rides their bike down a road slower than you drive your car. The fact that they are in your way sickens me. Okay, so you get the sense that he's sort of using the sarcastic tone to put out his own ideas. We see that both of these blogs also include an entry on the cyclist that was killed in Tennessee just a couple of weeks ago. And the official blog tries to report it in a very official way, much like we would expect the news to do. But obviously, they're taking a stance on this situation, and that stance is very clear. But the personal blog takes this and talks about their own feelings about it, talks about conversations that they've had with other people about the situation. And so we see this really personal stance coming through. So if we go to this idea of collective engagement, we see that there are a number of different methods for developing sort of a social network on each of these blogs. On the official blog, they have this opportunity where you can share your comments through email. So you have the opportunity to comment on the blog and to give your input, but it's not made publicly available to other viewers of the blog. It's just going to the administrator. Whereas on the private blog, they have those comments embedded in the blog itself. And so if you go to this blog and you are reading what he has entered, you can also click and see what other people are saying about it. You can contribute and enter this conversation. And this list of comments comes up in this other little window, and you can read what others are saying. Both blogs also have the opportunity for you to follow them. And so when people decide to follow your blog, they get email notifications and things when you've updated. And so you're creating this network of people who are interested in the same things as you. And then we have this idea of the web of knowledge. And these two blogs offer a couple of different opportunities for building this web of knowledge. The official blog has this list of links of resources that might be interesting to you if you're concerned about biking in Nashville. And the private blog or the personal blog does the same thing, but instead of just having links that are about biking in Nashville, he also has links of other things that are personally important to him. So we see a little bit of a difference there. The official blog also has this list which they call Cool Tools. And they list a lot of the same things that Aaron showed us before, the Map My Ride and the cost-benefit analysis and things. So it's linking out to tools that if you want to learn more about biking, you can go to these tools. The personal blog also has this thing they call the blog roll. And so they link to blogs of other people that are blogging about the same kinds of things, about biking in Nashville or biking in general. And so we see there are lots of ways here that this web of knowledge is being built between people, between resources. And the final thing on this idea of the web of knowledge is that they're including multiple media. So they're embedding videos from, this one's from a news station, News Channel 5, and this one's from YouTube. And so they're embedding multiple media. We saw some images, and at the same time linking out to other resources. So this web is just getting really big. And you can see how, as students are linking out to these resources and embedding them and remixing them, that there's a lot of really cool thinking that's happening there to allow them to do that. Knew I was going to do that at some point or another. All right. So as we think about, you know, what are we hoping that students gain when they're writing? We all have sort of ideas about what it is that we want students to do and to learn. And these are some ideas that we have had about the core competencies that are being learned through participating in iSearch 2.0. And this is coming from the O'Reilly a piece that has been referenced earlier, as well as our own sort of thoughts about what we think or how we think participating in iSearch 2.0 could benefit students. All right. Thank you so much for coming. If you have questions, we would be happy to entertain them.
Yes, we have time for questions. Then I think we're going to close by taking up an offer.
I have a question actually in that last slide, because it reminded me of something I was thinking about earlier in relation to some of your presentations, and that's about the evaluative stance. So one of the things that always stresses me out as a writing consultant working with a student on research is that it seems like the skill that's most underdeveloped is the capacity to evaluate the different things that the researcher might find. And so I guess I wonder, I know you talked about it in terms of having a teacher as a guide in these moments, but I wonder if you could say maybe more specifically or something more about the kind of guidance that goes on, so maybe also listed some questions that might be relevant to ask. But it seems like that's a skill that doesn't take, or that plagues students who in college find themselves having to do research, perhaps of a slightly different sort even from this year.
So one thing from traditional research that students can pretty much bank on is that the sources they go to, the reference materials are objective and are correct and can be trusted. However, in iSearch, the kinds of media that they're encountering, they'll hopefully be forced through this process to recognize that they're coming from a particular stance. They're subjective, they can be very opinionated, and sometimes provide incorrect information. So one of the things that we hope that students learn through the process is how media does take on a very subjective role, and that it can be interpreted in many ways, that statistics can tell any story they want. So that's one of the things hopefully that they will learn just by going through the process, and the teacher can obviously assist by questioning and coming at different levels.
I think in particular being a producer is what will hopefully help students be aware of media messages and how they're created. So as opposed to handing in a paper to my professor, if I go on Wikipedia and I make a change there that everybody can see as a creation of knowledge, then I recognize that there are other people doing that same sort of thing. So I don't know that we have evidence that happens. It's sort of, I think, our sense that that's an important piece of this, that being a participant will cause you to have a different outlook on the consumption of information. But another piece of this, a really important part of Web 2.0 culture, is taking things and remixing them and putting them to new uses. And I think that that really troubles our notions of traditional plagiarism. And the one of the things that we didn't really focus on is a key Web 2.0 idea is some rights reserved. So the idea that there's like a creative commons of stuff that you can use, but you can't use it for everything. So maybe you can draw on a database for your own personal use, but you can say that you created the database. And so I think that that's a big question we need to think about. It changes. It makes important the idea of source tracing. I don't know if we're getting at really how you can do this, but I think these are all kinds of important things to be thinking about.
Source tracing, which we're developing and thinking about, is thinking about information resource as being interconnected to other resources. I think this is really hard for students to get, but a simple measure of that is sort of something like what are incoming and outgoing links, and tracing the way in which the source is connected and held and has expresses a certain interest or investment by its connections to other sources. Key thing that a lot of times students miss because they land on a particular idea and they isolate it in their mind as sort of like existing on its own. It doesn't exist on its own. And I think, of course, that's an idea that you can.
read writing 1.0 or Web 2.0 is that it's much more difficult than we pretend it to be. We sort of think of it as a sort of check sheet kind of activity, and it's just not, because I think so many of the measures that we bring to bear on evaluating our research, if you look at experts in any given domain, and there's been some study of their own evaluations of resources, their own readings of research articles as compared even to graduate students or undergraduates, a lot of what they end up doing is based on personal connections to people who have written the material. And so they're not just somehow using some objective stance, but they're saying, oh, this is true. Oh, that's not true. I remember reading that study earlier. And you see these kind of reading practices, and they end up being incredibly social practices that go, quite a few steps deeper than these ideas that by physical evidence on the text, we'll sort of know if it's credible.
I have a question too that's about evaluation, but about the evaluation of the work that comes out of the brick work that comes out of research 2.0. And I guess it pertains to Blaine's portion of the presentation. You reported that students have more success with ill-defined assignments than well-defined assignments, presumably because they have more freedom to do what they want to do, so on and so forth. My question is, what does success mean there? How do you evaluate these types of assignments, especially since in the traditional sense, the success of the paper was in how well the question was answered, and if there's no question, what are the metrics you're using for evaluation to determine the success?
I think one measure is in the contribution that we're looking at. So I think also that it's definitely different. If it's personal, if it's kind of success is more gauged by the student than by the teacher in some way, which makes it really difficult to, grade, or but it's not, looking with a rubric and evaluating it that way. I'm not sure if that really helps.
So when you say it has something to do with their contribution, usefulness is sort of a measure of how much this student contributed to some domain and helped others learn things.
Well, and it's also from the reflection and kind of the contribution that they've decided that they want to give, so maybe using that as the measure for success.
So in a sense, they're setting their own goals.
Yes.
These are things that are important, this last slide. And so our students doing those things. As we've talked about, I don't think we've come to any idea necessarily of what the right kind of contribution is. We've sort of had really interesting discussions about, in the discussion today, it was presenting to NAMPO. But what if you just adjusted a Wikipedia and found things that were false and changed them? How do you measure the relative weight of those contributions? So it's a really good question. And when writing is something that, at least in academic context, usually has to be graded, that really throws us off. How do we assign grades to assignments that are ill-defined, and kids have spent time messing about all of that troubles in a good way, hopefully. I think it helps us to think about why we really want students to be writing and researching as opposed to so we can write a letter on a piece of paper.
It's something else, comparing to like a 5 or 10 page research paper where everything is laid out for you. I think a lot of these processes are likely to be hidden throughout the way. So I think it's important that the students or you set out a way for students to really identify the process they went to and document all the way through. And then you can kind of come up with your own evaluation system for how that, how that should be looked upon.
When you're talking about addressing different learning styles, does
forums that would, you know, that students would be drawn to based on their learning styles. Like, obviously, there would be more, maybe some, like, blogs that would be more of a narrative format.
I mean, I think that's a great question. I think there are certainly students that are going to be more comfortable writing what we think of as a traditional report. And so maybe the important question is why? Why are they more comfortable with that? And how would participating in some of these other forums kind of push that? And what would it allow them to do that writing a traditional report wouldn't allow them to do? Because I think, you know, a lot of these possible products that we talk about do have opportunities for students that are really comfortable just writing. Like, there are, like Aaron just said, I mean, you could have a blog that's really just a narrative. And so that might be kind of an entry point to allow them to start exploring different media types and proposing those different media types.
And do you propose this as the standalone assignment, or in an ideal setting, is there a mix, or how does that work?
I think the multipleness of it is important. So multi-genre doesn't imply that all the, and multiple modes, multimodal doesn't mean that everything is a YouTube video. I mean, there could be lots of other sorts of composition, including writing and pieces of paper. I think we're not saying that that isn't necessarily a piece of it. But I also think we should be really aware of the world in which, just the other day, a newspaper that's been around for 100 years is no longer on paper. That's like something that's happening in the world, and students need to be able to, it sort of are naturally, I think the Edo et al. Piece that we addressed a few times points to the fact that kids are able to do this messing around bit across lots of domains.
And since these are things that, you know, young people might already be involved with and at a social level, it might tend for them to be more invested in it, you know, as a way to look at academia as well.
Something else I wanted to stress was that, say, example for a report where you're doing quantitative data, you could still say make an iMovie and do and show the human face to the issue and interview people and have that in addition to your written paper.
My question is, to what extent does an assignment like this require the instructor to know how to do all of the technical stuff that the students were then expected to do? Because I can imagine myself having like lots of creative ideas for how I might want to respond to such an assignment, but I would need like a tech person to perform those things.
I think you definitely need, so there's the equipment aspect, so they're being very practical, you need to have access to certain things, such as computers or possibly digital cameras or even video cameras if you're going to do something like interviewing students. But I think that beyond that, the knowledge of what is out there, like you were saying, okay, I have these great ideas, and I think that is your starting point, because it's amazing all of the resources that are available online in terms of this is how you use this product, this is, here's the tutorial, here's the help thing. It's also, you know, we need to look at what the students are going to bring with them and use them as tutors in terms of, well, this person knows how to use this program, this person knows how to do this. So I think that there are a couple of different factors that would play into that, but I don't think that the teacher necessarily has to be an expert in all the fields associated with it, but rather they need to be open to different fields and allow students to bring in what they know, as well as being ready to draw on resources that are available online or possibly in a tech department or other supports.
Yeah, the expert paradigm's already upset, right, in a lot of classrooms these days, because the students are so much more tech savvy than their own teacher.
Yeah. I mean, that's my situation.
Yeah.
I couldn't claim to teach anybody how to create a hyperlink, but I could tell them I think it'd be a good idea to put one there.
But so you don't, I guess my point is, I don't think that you would need to have to. I think
yeah.
that you would instead need to give the opportunities to do that and to have an idea of what it is that exists out there. So one of the slides had all, Tara had some suggestions of different social media. So it'd be familiarizing yourself with what a wiki is and what are some characteristics of wikis and blogs and things like that. So that when students are saying, well, here's this information and I want to do something that
looks like this, you say, oh, Wiki would be perfect for you, or oh, you should try this. You don't necessarily have to be able to do the technical aspects of it, but to point them in the right direction. And because I think a part of it is figuring it out as you go.
So figuring it out.
Yeah, that process is an important part, piece of it.
I think in cases where you do need a tech person, she's like sitting in the seat over there, which is kind of what Emily said. It's your students know what to do. So you can always draw from what they're
doing. And I think that, I mean, with using all this technology and also drawing on each other's expertise really helps the collaborative writing process, you know, pulling it from just the single solitary act at the desk until you publish it for an audience of one person, your professor, to really broadening the audience and participation. You can get a lot of feedback in creating, a lot of feedback in revising, and also just a lot of feedback to your
community. Yes. The thought that I had, though, is the terms of that. I wonder how that would play into evaluation. So some students would have to do more work in order to figure out how to create a wiki than other students would have to do. So they then get more credit for that.
Well, and I think Erin was saying about the process being so important and offering students some way to document all of the steps they go through. And it's not just about finding the sources, but it's also about this process of, well, I thought a wiki was going to work great, and I started doing it, but it really didn't work, so I had to abandon that, and then I shifted over to this. And so you get the student who may possibly end up only making a couple Wikipedia entries, but if you knew the process and all of the different routes they went down to begin with, your evaluation would be different than if all you did was, if you only looked at their end product. Whereas you may have a student who, from the beginning, knows, I'm going to make this blog, and this is what it's going to contain these things, and they were able to devote more time to it because they weren't shifting between different modes.
That said, I think some of the very best teaching moments I've had with NIMBY, say in digital storytelling, personal memoir, and so on, have been experiences where the student's attitude at the end of the thing was kind of like, I don't care what grade you give me. Like, you're going to give me a C? That would be really dumb. Like, I have no idea how hard I worked on this and how important this is to me. And then, but that importance to them, the connection, the sense of their lives and stuff. And the grade just sort of, I mean, it kind of slips into second. Like, yeah, those hero stories don't always happen, you know, and sometimes they don't. But that sense that you're sort of losing that institutional loss or that institutional force that keeps so much running, and somebody's just grabbed it and said, it's taken on his own life. It's really kind of an exciting thing. And I have experienced that with NIMBY at different times.
Following up on that, I think that's the piece that I'm missing, is how your understanding of what they have done, what is the tool, is it that you meet with the students and they tell you their process, have they been tracking this, they're writing it down, I mean, what's the, are they blogging about their experience, about their research, how is that handled, is that open to you as the instructor?
Well, I think we've talked about just those options you mentioned. A blog might be a great way to keep track of what you're doing along the way.
It might be student-teacher conferences. It might be journals. It might be, I think it could take on a variety. It could be a video diary. I think that it could take on a variety of forms.
And again, it could be different from student to student, depending on which one you see might be most fruitful for them to use and more likely to have them actually document their reflective process.
One of the things I'm hoping they do is not only that they document their process, and including their messing around and the different things that led them to the final end product, but that they're thinking about their own learning and how they have actively constructed their knowledge and how they've taken things into a complex context and were able to arrive at their final learning point. So I would like for them to think about the learning process itself in addition to the process.
Building a great audience. Next time we'll bring even more presenters.
And music.
Next time.